My Word.
A panel game devised by Tony Shrine and Edward J. Mason. And here to introduce the teams is Michael O'Donnell.
Thank you very much, and welcome to another competitive bout of verbal erudition between our teams of hand-picked erudites, Dillis Powell and Frank Muir. And Antonia Fraser and Dennis Norden. But first, let us stray into a few forgotten nooks and crannies in the dictionary in search, as always, of meaning. Frank, what is the meaning of majuscule? M-A-J-U-S-C-U-L-E.
That's a capital question.
Oh, yes.
It means a large capital letter in printing and probably in writing. As distinct from minuscule.
But does minuscule mean a small letter in printing? I always learn something on this program. Anyway, 2 marks to Frank.
I would have thought that half a bonus mark might have been...
Now, I've had a stern memo about we're over budget on the bonus mark. as always. Now, majuscule, a large or capital letter. Antonia, what is an ephemeron?
Ephemeron.
E-P-H-E-M-E-R-O-N.
While I'm thinking, can I suggest that majuscule, which is what I thought it was going to be, was the Queen Mother's handbag?
Reticule. Lovely. Yeah.
Which still leaves me with the problem of...
Ephemeron.
Ephemeron. Well, it must be something short-lived.
I can give you a clue, which is a sort of rather poignant tale, true, happened to me when I was a young doctor about 20 years ago. I looked after a nice old lady who'd been a gaiety girl, and one day she said to me, "You know, doctor, I was born to be an ephemeron, and I end up as an old lady of 90. And it's the first time I'd ever heard the word, and I went back and looked it up. Now, does that help you or not?
Oh, wait, is it a...
It's like a
mayfly.
Listen to Dennis. Listen.
A mayfly.
Yes. Getting near to it. It's more general than a mayfly. That's a bit specific. Short-lived.
Yes. A short-lived fly.
Yes. Yeah. A creature, particularly an insect, that lives for one day only. It says in the in the dictionary. And what a day it must be. Anyway, we'll give you 2 marks, I think, for that, Antonia. Well done. That's why I sound so grudging about it. They're not my marks. They belong to the BBC. Dillis, concupiscence. What's the meaning of concupiscence? One of those words we used to look up in the dictionary at the age of 12.
Never knew how to pronounce it.
No.
Concupiscence. Have I got it right?
It means...
No.
Excessively desiring.
Of... Are you going
the other
on?
Other sex.
Yes, that'll do.
The other sex.
Yes, that'll do.
Perhaps the same sex, I don't know.
Vehement. Yes, libidinous. It's one of those words, isn't it, where the definition is much more seductive than the actual meaning. I mean, the words you have to use to describe it. In fact, what it says in the dictionary, it says, vehement desire for, and it then says, things of the world, in quotations, which suggests mine is an old edition. But then it goes on to libidinous desire, sexual appetite, and lust.
Lust.
It's a marvellous definition. Anyway, 2 marks to Dillis. Well done. Dennis, invultuation, I-N-V-U-L-T-U-A-T-I-O-N.
You get hardship money if you have to work antisocial hours. You get hardship marks for this. Invultuation, I have no idea, I've never heard the word, probably never will again. I tell you what it looks like. It looks like involuntary recitation, which is something... that you can do. I always remember last winter, it's the state of suddenly, without meaning to, falling into rhyme. Have you ever done that? It's very off-putting. Well, last winter, when it was very snowy and so on, they put out a thing on the news where they said you should remember the birds and the hardships that the birds have to suffer in this kind of weather, and you should give them something to drink because everything's frozen. And the lady who was reading this said, the Earl of Lytton found a bittern upon his frozen lake, and then suddenly stopped as she realised she'd unwittingly fallen into doggerel. And it is awful because it's easy to... I think that could be a state of involuntary recitation or invultuation.
I think that one and a half there for inventiveness. And it's quite close to the real meaning, which is the making of waxen images to stick pins into. So, now, before we go on to the next round here, Frank and Dennis are the quotations you were given for the last round, and Frank's is Hallelujah from the song of the same name, and Dennis's is Maybe It's Because I'm a Londoner, song by Hubert Gregg. And meanwhile, here's the next question for Antonia. An unusual move, this. What's so special about this sentence, Antonia? Sometimes when I feel low, I study the Evening Standard as though for an examination.
Well, it's one of the most brilliant sentences, I think, that has ever begun a modern novel. And if anybody wants to know how it goes on, because they're already grabbed by it, they should go out and buy Quiet as a Nun by Antonia Fraser. It is, in fact, the beginning of the Jemima Shaw series.
Was it the very first book?
It was the very first sentence of the very first book. And I can see people already leaving the hall and dashing up.
They're specially stocked up in the bookstore around the corner. I slipped that in, actually, because the next round is first sentences of books. I'm going to give you the first sentences, and I want you to name the books. And the example that's always given is from Rebecca. Last night I dreamed I went to Mandalay again, but I thought it... sometimes when I feel low, I study the Evening Standard. was more arresting. Anyway, Frank, here's the first line of a book. What's the book and who's the author? It was a cold, bright day in April, and the clocks were striking 13.
It's the beginning of 1984.
Yes, by George Orwell. 2-1.
Once you read the clocks have struck 13, you never forget it. It's wonderful.
Antonia, I think is easy. All children except one grow up.
Peter Pan?
Yes, yes. Must be, mustn't it? By Barry. Well,
yes.
Done. Dillis, this is one I think really is a very good first sentence in a novel. Hale knew before he had been in Brighton 3 hours that they meant to murder him.
Brighton. I think it's Brighton Rock.
Yes, it is. Graham Greene. Well done. As always, we have something rather special for Dennis.
Medical literature.
Not medical.
It's an Anglo-Saxon chronicle of something.
I'll just give you the line. You will not find your father greatly changed, remarked Lady Moping, as the car turned into the gates of the county asylum.
Yes, that is an unforgettable... In fact, the name is an unforgettable one. It's a very typical Evelyn Waugh name. And it's that marvellous short story, Mr. Loveday's Little Outing.
Well done.
It has a marvellous line in it when she goes in with her daughter Angela, wasn't it her daughter Angela, and they go into this place, and she might have said, that's reserved for the lower class loonies. And it's a chilling, wonderful short story. Mm.
It's a bit of a cheat, actually, because it's not really the beginning of a novel. It's the first story in a collection. It's work suspended, I think, is the...
I don't know. It's in so many anthologies that you could give about 8 answers, I would think. And the listener, actually, with all due respect, has some lovely opening line. I've collected a few. One is, Gluck is a hard taskmaster. And the other one is, Billie Jean King is very lobbable.
Well, we now move on to a round of missing first lines. I'm going to give you some second lines and tell me what is the well-known first line that comes immediately before the one I'm going to give you.
No iron bars are king.
How did you guess? No. Here we go. And burnt the topless towers of Ilium.
Was this the face that launched a thousand ships?
It was. 2 months. Antonio, dig the grave and let me lie.
Under the... Dennis, help. Under the something sky.
Under the... and... sky.
Audience, any help? under the wide...
Sorry.
It's come into my head. Under the... under the wide and starry sky, with acknowledgements to a charming lady in the audience.
Well, we'll give her a bonus mark, because we're allowed to give those out. We'll give you two. Well done, Antonio.
Thank you.
Mr. R.L. Stevenson's Requiem. Dillis, tears from the depths of some divine despair.
Oh, that's Tennyson.
Yes, indeed.
Tears, idle tears, I know not what they mean.
Perfect. Well done, Dylan. And Dennis, this is... the line is actually a little motto that I think every Victorian ironmaster had poker-worked and put up in the canteen. But the second line that he didn't put up was, year after year it steals till all are fled.
Yes.
You've lost your watch.
Procrastination.
I can hear
your procrastination. Is the thief of one of the dullest motto. Yes, procrastination. Is it procrastination is the thief of time?
I'm just nodding him on.
No, yes. I was led into it by Antonia's watch. A very vivid gesture, very graphic, eloquent gesture there.
Procrastination is the thief of time. That's Edward Young on procrastination. The Vicar of Welling. He was. Did you know? I didn't know he was a vicar. Before he'd had
Tree
a garden.
Garden City.
Yeah, Tree Garden City. A quick round of these words that sound the same but are spelt differently. Frank, two words, sound the same, spelt differently. One means to lift up, the other to knock down.
Raise.
Well done. 2 marks. Antonia, the substance of trees and a willing past participle. The good.
Oh, wood.
Well done.
Wood,
well done. Yes. I knew Frank would approve of that one. You probably heard that giggle in the background. Dillis, a solid element and courageous virtue.
Metal.
Well done, Dillis. 2 marks. Dennis...
I was on it.
Dennis, an accumulation of valuables and an accumulation of people.
H-O-A-R-D-H-O-R-D-E.
That's right. Hoard and horse. Well done. 2 marks all round. We now come to the last round of Frank's and Dennis's quotations, and Frank is the single word, hallelujah.
Oh, a lady rang me up for an in-depth interview, and she asked me the usual really penetrating questions, like, what is my sign of the zodiac, and what is my favourite colour, which happens to be beige. and then she at a loss as how to pad out the thing, she said, have you ever had a year when nothing went right? I thought of 1968. It was there's little mistakes one makes on programs, and it was a television program called Call My Bluff, in which one has guests. And I had one of those strange Freudian crosses in the mind in introducing my lady guest. And I introduced the Marchioness of Tavistock as Thora Heard. And I, of course, wrote instantly and apologised to both. But I think the... I think the probably the worst year was 1979, and that was really frightful. Again, it was Call My Bluff. We used to do it from Manchester in those days, and Patrick Campbell, old Paddy Campbell, and I used to have to spend 2 days there because we did two shows because of the fares of going up there, you know, in third class. And we had the second day free, and a BBC producer called Duncan Wood told me from vague authority that in Manchester you could get hot pot, Lancashire hot pot, and a stripper for £1.50. And Paddy Campbell was riveted with this because he thought it would make an item for his column in the Sunday Times. And we had to try and find in this afternoon we had this hot pot and strip. So we separated. And I went incognito. So I took my pink bow tie off. And in fact, I wore an old Etonian tie, which I borrowed from the hotel porter. And I went charging around trying to find this strip and hot pot for £1.50. I couldn't find it anywhere. And this is about sort of 2:30. We had to be at the show at 5. And I stopped a lad in the street and said, "Where does a red-blooded man have a bit of enjoyment in Manchester in the afternoon?" And he said, "Well, there's Bear Brolly." I thought, "That's it. That's it. There's a stripper's name, if ever I heard of it. Brolly Cadillac." I said, "Well, where is it?" And he said, "It's up free trade hall." So I went for free trade, and it was £1.50 to get in. And I went in, and it was a sort of auditorium. And there was an enormous orchestra on the stage. I thought it was a bit much to introduce a stripper. And no sign of a hot pot. And I glanced at the programme of the chap sitting next to me, and in fact it was apparently the Halle Orchestra under Sir John Barbarolli, who were playing this concert. Well, fair enough. And everything was all right until sort of halfway through I noticed that the zip on my trousers had come, you know, it's one of those trick ones, and it had come undone. So I bent down and zipped it up again, and not being used to ordinary ties, I found I'd zipped both ends of my tie irremovably into the zip, bent over. So I waited till the end of a movement, and then hobbled out and found the loo. And they're very old-fashioned in the Free Trade Hall in Manchester, the home of the Halle Orchestra. And you had to put 10p piece in a brass thing, which is very difficult when you're bent double. But I found one which said not in use, which I thought was nice, you know, to know that it was vacant. So I went in that and slammed the door. And the door made a sort of funny noise, the lock made a funny noise. But I managed to disentangle the tie and then couldn't open the door. So it was one of these old-fashioned loos with a gap underneath. So like a sort of failed limbo dancer, I tried to urge myself under. But I was 1/4 inch too big. So the only thing to do was to strip off completely. So I hung my clothes neatly on the hook, stripped off, and got just under the door. And then couldn't get in from the other side either, because my 10p pieces were in the trousers. Now, here's a bit of a situation, you see. But luckily, it was the washroom, and they had one of those roller towel affairs. So I got to the end of it, and ripped off a chunk, and wound it round me, putty style, and then dhoti style, and then turban style. And then trailing the end, I rushed out to try and find a taxi to get to the studios. Now, I do think it was the Halle Orchestra management's fault for not saying a notice, not putting a notice on the door saying, "Be careful, this door leads onto the stage." I think that was where they went wrong. And the other thing was having a spring on the door so that it closed as I went through, trapping the end of my towel. So as I walk forward, I span round and unwound. Anyway, the whole thing is too awful an episode. I can scarcely remember it. All I can say is that if anybody, such as the lady from the Cat magazine, said, is there a year when something really went wrong? And I say to her, yes, 1979. Hallelujah.
Thank you very much, Frank. I don't think I'll be able to keep a straight face at the Free Trade Hall. I'll have to give up going to concerts there. Dennis, let's see how you get on with... Maybe it's because I'm a Londoner.
You know, it's only lately that they've come up with a word that adequately describes what I was like as an adolescent. The word is wimp. Because that was exactly me at 16. Timid, insecure, shy... spineless as spaghetti, and from early childhood cosseted and overprotected to an extent that even when I took on a newspaper round, my mother followed me with an umbrella. So you can imagine my feelings early in 1939 when I was told that I was to be evacuated to somewhere in the country. Now, to a lad whose idea of roughing it was wearing a shirt that hadn't been laundered with fabric softener, anywhere north of Finchley represented deprivation, danger and discomfort. Who was going to press flat any lumps in my mashed potatoes? Who could I depend on to iron the tongues of my tennis shoes? In the event... It wasn't quite as bad as I anticipated, because I landed up in a tiny Wiltshire village called Testing, the home of a Mr. George Burbage, who was not only the village policeman, but his telephone number actually was Testing 1212. The other unexpected bonus was that PC Burbage had a daughter who turned out to be practically exactly my age and my height. Now, height may seem a strange recommendation to you, but as I believe I've mentioned before on these talks, at 16 I was both 6'2" and so painfully thin I made Gandhi look chubby. And as that made me seem even taller, my romantic life was practically non-existent, owing to the fact that the girls one met at dances in those days would only dance with short blokes because, as I was once told, they never see when your roots are showing. Well, wonder of wonders, PC Burbage's daughter was both as tall and as thin as I was. And never mind if that meant that whenever she shrugged her shoulders, her chest more or less disappeared completely. Much more important was the fact that, having never met anybody from London, she was obviously rather taken with me. Because at that time, and to this day, come to think of it, I was incapable of fancying anybody who didn't fancy me first. So I changed my mind about getting the next train back to London and devoted myself to May, because that was Miss Burbage's name, despite the conventional wisdom of that era, i.e. that any girl named May never actually did. I still set about seeking some romantic way of impressing her even more. What I very quickly learnt was that the way to May Burbage's heart was through her seat. In other words, that her main passion in life was horse riding. Well, there wasn't a lot of that back in Golders Green. About the only horse I'd been anywhere near was the one we dried the washing on. But such was my infatuation, I asked her if we could go riding together one morning. Her eyes glowed. "We'll take the path through the woods," she said, causing my knuckles to whiten and my Adam's apple to perform a sort of backward flip. Be at the stables tomorrow at 9, and I'll tell them to have Dobbin ready for you. Well, that name was reassuring. I reckon there couldn't be much to fear in any equine creature they called Dobbin. But just the same, I decided to get there just a bit earlier because there's bound to be a few things that an unhorsey person should sort of sort out beforehand, like where the starter button was, you know, whether or not they'd tightened the syrup. So, 7:30 next morning, I hired me to this local Hertz rent-a-horse, and there was Dobbin. What I mean is, striking sparks on the stonework with his hooves and resisting the combined efforts of four exhausted-looking men wearing what I believe are called jodhoppers, there, blotting out the sun, was this enormous sort of semi-brontosaurus. And here was I, a city-bred lad, expecting something on the lines of the pony that had pulled Cinderella's coach at the Gold Screen Hippodrome. Do I need to tell you that 10 minutes later I was on the Paddington train and stuck on Dobbin's giant steaming flank, awaiting Miss Burbage's arrival, was a short explanatory note addressed to her. It read, "Maybe it's a big horse. I'm a Londoner."
Thank you, Dennis. It's nice to know you had some rural adventures. Anyway, I see from the score that it's Dillis and Frank we have to send round on the lap of honour this week. Just go ahead. And Antonia and Dennis have to sneak back to the dressing room in shame. But they'll make a big comeback, I'm sure, in our next programme. And until then, goodbye.
In My Word, Michael O'Donnell was in the chair. The questions were compiled by Peter Moore, and the programme was produced for the BBC by Tony Shrine and Pete Atkins.